knows how many watts are being fed into it and gives you the correct reading on the gauge, the instrument itself, the meter movement itself. How does it know that 45 watts is what it's seeing and it's telling you this? What determines this information? Go ahead.
That's not a silly question. By the way, there are no silly questions. There are no dumb questions for the TechNet. A person who thinks he's got a dumb question is really recognizing the fact that what he knows and what he likes to know has a bigger gap. There are no dumb questions. That's a darn good question, Vito. And I'm going to give the example of a bird watt meter with that slug where you can adjust it for forward power or reverse power. And if you study what a bird watt meter is, it really is a miniature version of a directional coupler where the sensing line on the directional coupler is inside of that slug and you can make it sense forward or reverse going energy. A directional coupler is a kind of chunk of electronics that you put in the middle of a transmission line, and when it's set up properly, it takes a small sample of the power that's flowing forward on the transmission line, the power that's flowing from your transmitter toward the antenna. That's if you get the slug set into forward mode. The way it does it is it's got a small loop of wire inside. The small loop of wire is held by the slug parallel to the main transmission line, the great big fat rod going through the middle of the bird watt meter. You take out that slug and you look down inside that hole, you'll see a big fat center conductor going through it. It really is a coax cable, even though the outside doesn't look like a nice round coax cable. It is. And inside of that slug, there's a small sampling wire that picks up a little bit of the power flowing forward. If, for instance, you've got the 100-watt slug plugged in, and you've got 100 watts coming out of your transmitter, let me drop. That little sampling wire that's inside of the slug is picking up, let me pick a number, 5 milliwatts of the 100 watts going down the line. You know, very, very little percentage of the power. Of that 5 milliwatts or so that it picks up, that piece of wire is carefully set up with the right kind of resistor on one end and the right kind of a bypass capacitor and a diode on the other end so that it takes the 5 milliwatts and rectifies it into a voltage. The voltage then goes through the two output leads on the slug and it goes over to the meter movement, which I think is a 50 microamp meter movement, but I'm not positive about that. So it rectifies the small amount of milliwatts of sampled power it picks up. After it rectifies it, it's now a pulsating DC voltage, which goes through a filter capacitor that becomes a steady-state DC voltage. That goes through a dropping resistor into the Dawson valve movement. And so you'll notice that the bird watt meter has a scale on it which is not linear. The power on the left-hand side, the lines are close together, and the right-hand side, they're far apart. And because it is rectifying a voltage, and since power is a function of voltage squared, it's properly calibrated. It knows that when 100 watts is flowing through for that particular slug, in my example, 5 milliwatts of it's going to be picked up. The 5 milliwatts becomes rectified. That represents a certain voltage and current that goes to the meter. The meter moves over to the 100-watt level, and you now know how much power is flowing forward. Let me drop. Then while you're using that bird watt meter, you grab the slug, you rotate it 180 degrees to the left, and it now is a directional coupler sensing power flowing in the other direction. It's now looking at reflected power coming from your antenna going back down toward the transmitter because your antenna has some standing wave ratio. If your antenna is not perfect, then it doesn't absorb all the power and some of it reflects. And by looking at the ratio of the forward power and the reverse power and going to a lookup chart, you now know what the standing wave ratio is. So it is a power sampling, directional coupler, rectifier, meter movement thing. And that's one of the very nice ways of measuring power. You and I could easily make a sampling network the way I did it on the very first transmitter I built way back in the dark ages of the late 1950s, Vito. I just took a 1,000-ohm resistor connected to the center conductor of my 1-watt transmitter. I was building a 1-watt transmitter on 6 meters. I think I used a 1,000-ohm resistor into a diode, and then the rectified voltage out of that diode went through another resistor into a meter movement that was on the front panel. I rectified the voltage I was picking up a small sample of. It's a 50-ohm connector, and with a 1,000-ohm, converting that into wattage of a steady-state signal is pretty easy. Register takes a little bit more complication. Check that.
Okay, believe it or not, I fully understand exactly what you're saying. And as you were talking, I was visualizing the innards of a bird watt meter. I know what that little channel you're talking about looks like a piece of coax. I saw the whole thing in my mind as you were speaking. And now I fully understand all of this, and due respect to the calibration of the meter and so forth, like a shunt on an ammeter, if it's properly calibrated, the proper shunt will give you the proper amperage passing through a circuit. It's not going through a meter, it's going through the shunt. So I believe that's what you're trying to say, and that's the case. I believe I fully understand. Go ahead.
You've got it, Vito. And now you're going to realize that a bird watt meter is a beautiful, very valuable, very popular instrument, but it's not doing any magic. What it does, once you have a little bit of understanding, it's not rocket science. If you now took the 1 watt slug, the 100 watt slug, and the 1,000 watt slug of your bird watt meter, and if you're willing to take them apart, and you ask yourself, how in the world can this thing read 1 watt full scale, 100 watts full scale, 1,000 watts full scale? You take it apart and you look inside, and assume that all of them are tuned to the exact same frequency range. You'll see the exact same little pickup wire, the exact same resistors and capacitors and diode rectifier network. The only thing that changes is how close is that pickup wire to that great big rod going down the center inside the bird watt meter. The 1 watt slug has its piece of wire very close, very far down inside, very close to that main rod going through, so that it can sample the same, it needs the same 10 milliwatts, but now it picks it up when there's only 1 watt flowing down the cable. And if you now took apart the kilowatt slug, you'll see the exact same piece of wire inside the slug is a greater distance away from that center wire of the center rod of the bird watt meter. So the spacing of that pickup wire determines what percentage of the power flowing through the watt meter it senses, and that's what gives you the 1 watt or 1,000 watt full scale. It's just a matter of distance setting. I wonder if you see that principle, Vito. On top of that, the one other piece of magic, and you're about to ask yourself, why in the world does the bird watt meter slug have a certain frequency range to it? Why can't it work from DC to light? Let me drop. And that's because a real directional coupler, the pickup line is usually a quarter wavelength long. Well, if the frequencies you and I operate at, that slug doesn't have anywhere near physical dimension, so that pickup wire is much too short in wavelengths. Therefore, it has a frequency response to it which favors the higher frequencies, and it doesn't favor the lower frequencies. They compensate for that inside by building a low-pass network. In other words, the signal being picked up by that wire goes through a filter, which passes the lower frequencies stronger than the higher frequencies to try to make it flat. But it only works for an octave or two, if you know what I mean. So that's the main reason why each one of those slugs has a particular frequency range and a particular power level at which they're designed for. And you can extend it a little bit. If your particular slug is rated for 200 megacycles maximum, and you use it at 432 megacycles instead, it's not going to explode, it's not going to catch on fire, just that the calibration will be a little bit different. And you could recalibrate it, in other words. Just that the meter might read a little bit too high, and you could compensate for that. But bird watt meters are a very handy thing, and you now have a little bit more of understanding how it works. And to homebrew one of those, you'd be amazed how easy that is, Vito. You could build the equivalent of a bird watt meter on the output stage of your transmitter by just building a little piece of wire that's real close to the type N or the UHF output connector with a pickup wire with a rectifying diode, and I've done that on some of my transmitters. So adding a watt meter to the inside of your transmitter takes you about a dollar's worth of components to do it, and don't hesitate if you want to sometime in the future. Back to you, Vito, for a final. WA2PJF, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Believe it or not, I fully understand exactly what you're saying, and understanding of different slugs is the gap that's plays a part, and the frequencies, if they're not correct, the meter will not read correctly, will not be accurate, has to be compensated, as you said, in the movement. I understand the whole thing. I was not sure of this. I only had a slight idea. Now I have a full idea. And a perfect, perfect explanation. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Back to you, Dick.
I think I would like to put myself for the space report with transmission lines and deep technet into the ship.
Okay, Wes. Hey, John, when it comes to Vito, it sounds like we've got a happy customer. We've got to send him a bill. That's a joke. Hal, I know you wanted to add something to transmission lines. As I said earlier when I tried calling you twice, I know you've worked with transmission lines a whole lot, and I bet you you've used Letcher wires, I bet you you've used the slotted line, and I bet you you've developed a whole bunch of QT techniques for understanding how they work. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. Yeah, Dick, I was in my car, I just got into the house, and you must have tried to reach me. Okay, what I wanted to basically say was there's a lot of ladder lines and miscellaneous coax cable and everything at Hamfest and flea markets. Many people, you know, would be afraid to buy something because maybe they wouldn't know what the impedance is of the cable or the ladder line or whatever. What I want to do is just give you a very easy way that you could measure the impedance of a transmission line, be it ladder line, coax, whatever it is. The only thing it needs is a little 1,000 ohm carbon pot and a grid dip meter. And a grid dip meter is a very common thing now for most amateurs to have. Very simple procedure. You take at least 15 feet of miscellaneous transmission line. I don't care if it's ladder line, coax, or whatever. Hold on. No more time out. You, at the opposite end of this piece of wire, put your 1,000 ohm carbon pot. On the other end of the piece of wire, put a two-turn loop connected to the transmission line as like a link. Put that link near your grid dip meter. Set your carbon pot midway to start with if you want. As you go from 140 megacycles down to like 3 or 4 megacycles, you're going to see a bunch of dips on the grid dip meter. What you do, you adjust this pot until where you turn your grid dip meter from 3 megs to about 150 megs, you see no dips. Once you see that point where you can go completely through that span of frequencies and see no dips, you take off that carbon pot, take an ohm meter that's accurate, measure the resistance of the pot, and that would be the impedance of the transmission line, be it ladder line, coax, etc., etc. Go ahead, Dick, K2RIW. This is K6DPC.
Hey, Hal, that's a very crafty technique. It turns out that on almost all microwave circuits above 144 megacycles, when you really want a very well-tuned circuit, like, for instance, the duplexing filter that's used at a repeater, those so-called cavity resonators really are a piece of transmission line with a short circuit at one end or an open circuit at one end. When the signal reflects back and forth, you get some very sharp tuning on a piece of transmission line. If there is a mismatch, a short circuit or an open circuit, a piece of transmission line has a terminating resistor at the far end that equals the so-called characteristic impedance of the transmission line, then the signal flows down there once, doesn't reflect back. If it doesn't reflect back, it can't resonate. So what Hal's doing with that potentiometer is that when he finds the magic number of ohms on the potentiometer, which properly terminates that coaxial, that transmission line, so the transmission line now sees its characteristic impedance as the load at the far end, then the signal being picked up by his grid dip meter, the two turns of wire that's on the input end of the transmission line, that signal flows down the transmission line, hits Hal's potentiometer, gets all absorbed, nothing reflects back, there is no resonance anymore, so he no longer sees any dips. That's what's going on. He's making a perfect impedance match, and he's finding the characteristic impedance. That's a very crafty technique. As you get up to 150 megacycles, you have to be a little bit careful with the way you physically set up that potentiometer. You'd like it to be a small potentiometer. If you had great big long lead lengths, you have some extra inductance in there, and you would get a slightly different reading. But that's a minor detail. The fact that he can operate the grid dip meter across many of the megacycles he's going to operate with allows you to find out right away, is it 600 ohm, 400 ohm, 300 ohm twin lead, is it 75 coax, 55 ohm coax, and so on. By the way, one of the things I'm discovering lately is that whenever you buy coaxial cable, from any of the good manufacturers, and it's rated 50 ohms nominal, and there used to be a mil spec defining that. You put any of the coax cables you can buy these days, braided coaxial cable, on a good vector network analyzer, you make a very interesting discovery. Let me drop. First of all, there no longer is a mil spec controlling coax cable or coaxial connectors. It's essentially become obsolete. The numbers are there for traditional reasons. They may call it a UG21 Gulf or a UG21 Baker connector, but it's no longer controlled by mil specs and those numbers. It's just really telling you physical characteristics. But many of the braided coaxial cables you can buy are really 51, 52, 53 ohms. One particular brand we bought recently because it was a very good price, we carefully measured it. It was 57 ohms impedance. Now, for most of the antennas you and I use, that's a minor problem. Don't worry about it. I was using that cable in a very critical location where I had to know the impedance to the nearest 1 ohm in order to really control the reflection coefficient of a high-performance antenna. And a 57-ohm cable on a 50-ohm antenna really disturbed the circuit that I was working on at that time. So it's something interesting to know about. Also, another thing to know about is that we amateurs occasionally have great access to 70-ohm coax cable hardline that's thrown out by or discarded by the cable TV companies. Cable TV uses 70-ohm cable for a bunch of reasons. It's a little bit lower in loss for the same diameter. Therefore, they don't have to put as many amplifiers per mile along their TV coax cable system. And 70-ohm cable, when you've got a 50-ohm transmitter and a 50-ohm antenna, there are guys who think the transmitter's going to explode, the antenna's not going to work, all not true. You're listening to 70-ohm cable right now that I'm using up my 100-foot tower. And it's a 50-ohm antenna, and you're listening to a 50-ohm transmitter. And a 70-ohm cable creates something like a 1.4 standing wave ratio on each end, which is minor. And there's ways of correcting it, but the price is right. You can get the 100 and 150-foot length of the stuff, the end of the reel, so to speak. They buy it in 5,000-foot reels, and when there's 100-foot left, they bring it back to the stockyard, and you can talk them out of it for a very inexpensive price, quite often free. And the cable, you try to go out and buy cable of the same performance, you might have to pay $5 per foot, and you can get it for free. And the stuff, particularly the stuff with the outer black polyvinyl chloride jacket on it, is made for direct burial for the next 20 years. You could bury that cable between the shack and the tower and underground for the next 20 years, and it works like a charm. So it's a very high-performance cable, real good price. The only thing that's difficult is putting connectors on the end. There's ways you can adapt the so-called stinger connector, that they quite often throw an awful lot of those out, and there's ways you can readapt that connector and reconnect it to a type N connector. So that impedance matching technique is a good one. I bet you you've used it on 4 or 5 different kinds of transmission lines throughout your career. Is that true, Hal? What was the highest impedance twin lead you've ever measured? What's the lowest impedance coax cable you've ever measured that way? K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2IW, K6DPZ. I measured some miscellaneous feed lines that were down about 35 ohms impedance, and I measured the lines that are up to almost 1,000 ohm impedance, 900 and something ohms. And it worked out very well. It's a fast way of doing it, so if you even try to make a piece of ladder line, and you make a miscellaneous piece, you can run a test on the ladder line, see what it is, and then figure out how you should feed your impedance to your antenna based upon the impedance of your ladder line. So, just my little sneaky way of doing things, Dick. Go ahead. K2RIW, TechNet, K6DPZ.
JTB with a comment.
Very fine, Hal. J2B recognized. Very crafty technique. Now, what Hal can do with that, say, for instance, he knew that his particular antenna was a 70-ohm antenna, and he's using 300-ohm twin lead. And he might calculate that if he uses a quarter wavelength of a particular transmission line of, let me pick a number, 221 ohms, that he would get a proper impedance match. He can either use a bunch of equations to figure out what spacing between two wires would give him 221 ohm twin lead, or by way of his potentiometer technique, he could very rapidly change the spacing between the wires, find out what spacing gives him the 220 ohms, put in a quarter wavelength of it, and now he's got an impedance matching transformer that matches his particular antenna to the rest of his transmission line. Let's see what Joe's got to say about all this. Those guys in this concept, how do they go about impedance matching, Joe? WJ2B, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, hello everybody on TechNet. This is Joe, WJ2B. I just had a question for you guys, if you knew or Hal knew if the MFJ analyzer, antenna analyzer, which is kind of popular, either the 259 or the 269, can be used, similar to what Hal is doing with the grid dip meter, because probably a lot of the more recent hams are using those MFJ analyzers instead of the older type grid dip meter. I was just curious if you can make that same type of measurement of line impedance, characteristic impedance. I believe that there is something on there that has a lot of submenus. I know a lot of people just use it for SWR readings and to get, resistive reactive component, but there is quite a few different submenus on those analyzers that you can do, length to the short, length to open, all kinds of stuff with characteristic impedance versus, different parameters. I'm just curious if anybody knows if that's one of the functions that the MFJ analyzer can do. Back to you, WJ2B.
Let me get it real fast. I got to get out of here, okay?
Yeah, make sure you wait for all four beeps, Hal. Go ahead.
All four beeps. Get the grid dip adapter coils for your MFJ analyzer. It makes it into a grid dip meter, and then you can do that procedure. Gentlemen, I got to run. Dick, take it. I just wanted to pass that along with some of my wide, uninteresting points that I've worked with.
Now, those are interesting comments you made, Hal, so you don't have to be that humble. Good information, I thank you. Come back and give us some more in the future. MFJ antenna analyzer, I believe it has a sweep frequency function to it. I think there's one of the modes you can operate it where it gives you a liquid crystal display that's a kind of a graph where it plots vertically standing wave ratio, horizontally in frequency. I think you can tell it what start frequency, what stop frequency to sweep from to. You can connect it to your transmission line in the shack and sweep your transmission line plus antenna, plot visual versus frequency, and get a lot of information. Once you can do things like that, you don't have to have an antenna at the far end of that transmission line. You can have Hal's potentiometer, and you can play with the setting of the potentiometer so that Dizwar curve now looks flat versus frequency, and I think you're finding the characteristic impedance of that transmission line. So does that 259 and a 269, I've seen some of these MFJ antenna analyzers do have a swept Dizwar function. So let me know, Joe, if the particular model numbers you're talking about do have that, and roughly how expensive are they? WJ2B, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, I don't think the one I'm thinking of, the 259, is the about 500 kilohertz through a 2-meter band, and the 269 is the 500 kilohertz through 2 meters, and then it also includes UHF, like 430 to 480. That one goes for about 369, and the 259 that doesn't have the UHF goes for about $269 new. But I don't believe they do automatic sweeps, similar to a vector network analyzer. I think you have to manually switch. There's a function switch, band switch on it, with segments of the band, and then there's a variable pot on there to change the frequency. And like you said, it has a digital readout of the frequency. But I think you can do other measurements on there. You don't even have to try to calculate things yourself. It has a bunch of functions that it can calculate different things for you, like distance to short, distance to open, things like that. But it has quite a few functions. Maybe we should have some type of a talk about the MFJ analyzer. I don't know if there's anybody that's a real expert on it, on frequency. I certainly am not. I've only used it hardly at all. But the thing's pretty useful. I don't know if I timed the thing out yet. Back over to you, Dick, WJ2B.
No, you didn't time it out, Joe. Not to worry. Yeah, I guess there's some merit in having a mini tutorial on the various models of the MFJ antenna analyzer. What can you do with it? And if you're saying that there is a version that will give you a distance to fault, is that what I heard you say? I've done things like that with a time domain reflectometer. And once you have a machine that can sweep in frequency, measure reflected signal, and measure reflected amplitude and phase, there is a very fancy chunk of mathematics called the Steinhelfer technique. And the Steinhelfer technique or Steinhelfer algorithm will allow you to do the equivalent of a time domain reflectometer, which is kind of a radar inside of a coax cable, and it will find the distance to a shore. So run that by one more time, Joe. Is there a version that you can buy with an auxiliary object or piece of software? Does one of the MFJs tell you distance to fault? If so, that's a very fancy technique. WJ2B, K2RIW on the deck, man.
Physics WJ2B. I have the 269. I have it in front of me right now, and I just turned it on, and the mode switch, it allows you to do impedance, resistive and reactive, coax loss, capacitance and picofarad, inductance and microhenry, frequency counter, and then it has a secondary mode if you hold the button down. Let me see what the secondary modes are. It has, I think it has two extra sub-menus. If you hold the mode button down, let me see what I get. I think you have to push both the buttons at the same time. Hold on a second. Okay, advanced menu one does reflection coefficient, and return loss and reflection coefficient, resonance mode to tune for reactance equals zero, match efficiency, impedance, magnitude, and phase, and then there's a second advanced menu, a third advanced menu. Yeah, there's a bunch of different things this thing can do. It can do distance to fault. Okay, hold on one second. I'm trying to get back to the second menu right now. Okay, advanced menu number two, you have to set the velocity factor of the cable you're using. Then after you do that, it will allow you to do distance to fault in feet, line length in degrees, line length in feet, and that's it.
Yeah, they may have done a simplified version, but if it really gives you with accuracy like a time domain reflectometer, distance to fault, that's a very fancy function. Sounds like a nice machine. Well done. I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in with questions before we go to John and Paul. John with his Mel's Corner, so to speak, and Paul with the Space Report. Let me make sure that of the people who signed in, I didn't skip over anybody. If you signed in with a question and we haven't handled you yet, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KD2BHY.
Yeah, Jim did sign in early, and boy, did I skip over you, Jim. Thank goodness I went back. Baker Hotel Yankee, go right ahead, Jim. And by the way, you've now had your license. Is it going on 2 months? You're an old-timer. KB2PHY, K2RIW. You got it, Jim.
Yep, I think on March 10th, it'll be 2 months. Oh, no, let's see, December, January, February. It has been 2 months. I passed the exam on December 10th, and February 10th has passed, so I believe it's going on 3 months. Yeah, I had a question about propagation. It's kind of two questions, but they're both related to each other. On my HT, how could I... Like, I know of meteor scatter and sporadic E, but are there any other ways on 2 meters of more than line-of-sight propagation? And every night I listen to a radio station on AM. It's this radio... It's a broadcast radio in my room. Every night I listen to, I forget the broadcast call sign, but it's a big band jazz station in Toronto, and I get it on the AM broadcast band, and I know that the ionosphere changes at night, and the B layer is, I believe it disappears. I'm not sure, but I believe the D layer disappears at night. I know the F1 and F2 layer combined, but how do I get that far radio station? Because, and the 2 meter question is because I lost the when I was in the hotel room. It was my birthday a week ago on February 21st, and in the hotel room I lost. Well, I didn't lose, but I put my general class Gordon West study manual on the table next to the couch that I was.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I was waiting for the four beeps. Yeah, you timed out the machine, but by going to the 147.375, I heard the rest of your rodeo, and I know you've misplaced your Gordon West study guide, which gave you an awful lot of this information. One of the things you're going to discover about radio, Jim, is that each individual frequency region has its own crazy characteristics. An AM radio, your AM broadcast radio, which is running between 0.57 and 1.5 megacycles, roughly one megacycle is the center of the band. The way one megacycle behaves, and you're listening to that Canadian station at nighttime, where you get the D layer disappears, the atmospheric absorption of the D layer disappears, and therefore the long range signal reflected from the ionosphere, probably the F layer, but I'm not sure, is coming in from
K2EJ.
Eric recognized the long range signal is coming in from a long distance. That's the way one megacycle behaves. In the case of 144 megacycle, the 2 meter ham band, it almost never uses the ionosphere, with rare exception. Sporadic E, a very intense cloud at the E layer, occasionally will reflect a 2 meter signal. When it comes to meteor scatter and moon bounce and some of these other exotic modes on 2 meters, almost all of those are done in the single sideband mode, almost always with fairly high gain antennas, at least one long Yagi or a group of Yagis. The Yagi itself is mounted in a place which has clear view of the horizon if you're doing terrestrial communication, like a meteor scatter, or it's got a clear view of the moon if you're doing moon bounce. So it's a high gain antenna, a preamplifier mounted at the antenna, quite often 100 watts of power, but almost always in the single sideband mode. Let me drop. So all of these exotic modes of 2 meter long range propagation, with rare exception, they're done in the single sideband mode as either a Morse code signal or a single sideband signal. The good news about single sideband is that it can tolerate a signal that is at least 10 dB weaker and sometimes quite a bit weaker, and you still get good copy of what the guy is saying in either Morse code or in single sideband voice. Very, very few of the guys are using FM for any of these exotic modes. During an occasional sporadic E operation or long-range ground reflection, not ground reflection, extended ground wave, which is sometimes called the super refraction. Occasionally late at night, when there's in the summertime in August, quite often it happens, late at night you get a lot of dew layer, a heavy atmospheric moisture content low down to the atmosphere, and a drier air up high, because the moisture in the air gives it a higher dielectric constant. You get a downward bending of the wave. The wave follows Earth curvature, and the guy that's 600 miles away from you sounds like he's in your backyard. That's called the super refraction phenomena on 2 meters. And occasionally, you'll hear that on FM. But most of these long-range projects, most of these so-called weak signal techniques, are almost always done in the single sideband mode. Let me drop. I can tell you've got a lot of interest in those, and there's more of them. There's the trans-equatorial mode. There's a field-aligned anomaly mode. There is the sporadic E. There is meteor scatter, moon bounce. There's a number of exotic propagating modes used on 2 meters. and 98% of them are all done in the sideband mode. So you're eventually going to want an all-mode 2-meter transceiver, one that has single sideband capability. You're probably going to also want to add a low-noise preamplifier to that receiver in order to bring it up to full sensitivity capability to really exercise these weak signal modes. If you go to the website called the Weak Signal Society, the New England Weak Signal Society, I think it's called, if you Google those words, you'll find the Weak Signal Society that meets in the Boston area. I was a member of that for quite a few periods of time, and they'll tell you about quite a few of the events that they carry on, go to, and whatever, to use these modes. Now, Eric, I bet you he's experienced an awful lot of extended ground wave on broadcast as well as ham radio, so let's see what Eric's got to say about this. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech band.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. I just wanted to bring up a point. The gentleman is probably listening to radio station CKLW. If anybody's ever done any AM DX thing, CKLW is on 800 kilohertz. It's a clear channel throughout the Northeast, and they're a 50 kilowatt omnidirectional station, and they're one of the oldest stations in Canada. I remember as a kid, when I was doing AM DX things, one of the real standard reference stations that you use was CKLW in Windsor, Ontario, and they put out quite a potent signal, but don't forget, it's on a clear frequency. K2RIW, K2.
As you can tell, Jim, each frequency range of radio propagation usually has very different characteristics. The D-layer absorption is something that you get up to about 80 meters, and then it doesn't happen anymore. The ionospheric reflection, typically you get that as high as 30 megacycles, and on rare occasion it goes higher. The extended ground wave can happen at almost any frequency, but it's the VHF frequencies and above where you see it. Rain scatter propagation is something that's very prevalent at 10 gigahertz ham band, but you're not going to hear that on 2 meters. Bouncing signals off of buildings and the mountains, the 432 and 1296 guys and above, they do things like that. Moon bounce is usually done on 144 megacycles and above, so each of the 10 or so different kinds of radio propagation, each frequency region has its own peculiar characteristics. I can tell by your interest you're going to eventually want to own a 2-meter all-mode transceiver, a 2-meter all-mode receiver transmitter that has single sideband capability, because when it comes to weak signal reception, a simple Yagi on... Let me drop... A simple Yagi, horizontally polarized, mounted to the chimney of the house, and a 100-watt solid-state transmitter connected to it, will, half the nights of the year, allow you to talk to somebody 200 miles away in the single sideband mode. In the FM mode, you wouldn't go anywhere near that far. So when it comes to long-range, weak signal, long-distance type propagation, even on the 2-meter band, you're going to want sideband capability. So keep your eye peeled for inexpensive, used, single sideband capable rigs. Do a little bit of research as to what's your favorite one. My favorite one is an old-fashioned thing called the Kenwood TS-711A. That's what you're listening to right now, Kenwood TS-711A. It's got some beautiful FM characteristics. It's got some beautiful sideband characteristics. It's the world's best synthesizer. It's an oldie. It probably was originally invented way back in 1985, 1990, in that time frame. And so a rig with equal capability today will cost you $1,800. On the used equipment market, I occasionally see these things for $200, and it's got almost the same capability. It's got a built-in power supply. Runs on 110 volts or 12 volts. It's got a carrying handle on the side. It's a desktop rig. It's not a mobile rig, but you could use it mobile. So you don't have to spend a whole lot of money, but you're eventually going to want sideband. From what I'm hearing, I can tell by your interest, Jim. KB2, Baker Hotel Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for all four beeps and try not to go beyond 1 minute.
All right, thanks, Dick. I'll definitely keep my eyes peeled for some all-mode capable 2-meter rigs. Yeah, it's really annoying, that misplaced book. I mean, March 4th, I was hoping to take the test, but I might have to, you know, go later. I'm going to run off now, go to sleep. So, 7-3.
And that displaced study guide, Jim. Consider buying another one. It may be a good investment. I know it's going to be wasting a little bit of your money, but there probably are people listening to me that might even volunteer their copy if they've got one. So Jim lost his study guide. What was the exact model number of the study guide that you misplaced, Jim? KB2BHY, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
I already ordered another one. Don't worry. It'll be here on Monday or Tuesday. Not sure which. But it was the Gordon West General Class Study Manual, 2011-2015 question pool. And I think I may have to just memorize the question because this week was February break, and I lost it on the 22nd. So I figured I could get a good chunk of the book done there, and then finish it, you know, this week. And then, you know, take the test a couple times, and then March 4th I'd be fully prepared. But, you know, I'm going to have to find some other way. March 4th is, you know, coming up. So I'll find a way.
Yeah, I know, Jim, you've been hearing various opinions by people about whether or not you should simply memorize the questions or try to understand it. And the answer is some kind of a mixture of the two. I first passed my general class license way back in the dark ages of 1956 by simply memorizing the question pool and going down to the FCC and taking the exam. And then it was getting on the radio and talking to people where all of a sudden I found out what the word watt and joule and ampere and volt really meant, and all of the words that I had memorized. Didn't really understand it. You'll learn that automatically. So on top of that, when it comes to the volunteer examiner tests that are given on Long Island, there's quite a number of those tests given at various locations throughout the month. So there isn't just one particular test you've got to go to. And even if at worst you fail a test, taking it again is relatively easy, not very expensive. So even if at first, the first time you take the test, you don't pass it, it's not a disaster. I didn't pass my code test the first time I took it, for instance. I did pass the theory section by memorization. So there's a lot of opportunity you've got there. You're going to have that general license in pretty quick order. Don't worry. Just keep hacking away at it. Okay, I think we've gone through all of the list of people who signed in. Let me double check to make sure I didn't skip over anybody. K2RIW and the TechNet.
I'm doing after Paul.
Roger, Dodger.
N2LDY.
N2LDY. I know you signed in last week, and go right ahead. Give me your name one more time, because I've forgotten it. N2LDY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I did. The handle is Dawn Delta Oscar November.
Go right ahead, Dawn.
Quick question about through the glass antennas, and the reason for this is I had a through the glass antenna mounted on my Grand Cherokee for the longest time, cracked windshield, hence I got a new windshield put in, but the position where I mounted the through the glass antenna now has like, looks to be like black paint, it's like a black polka dotted paint, and I'm wondering if I went ahead and mounted it there, is that going to affect the properties of the antenna, if anyone has had any experience in this area of that gift?
Very fine, Don. Don, you could use a little bit more audio. It comes through very clearly, but the audio is a tiny bit low. That black polka dotted area that's on the windshield, I'm a little bit worried that that could be the built-in defroster. Many of the modern-day windshields have a conductive layer of quasi-transparent material and some of those have a polka-dotted metal perimeter on the windshield where the electrical contact is made for that built-in defrosting function. And if that's true, propagating through that could be a bit more difficult. And so I don't know a way to tell you whether or not you've got a problem with that area. It's good that you're asking the question. It is a potential problem area if it is the built-in conductive automatic defroster function. I wonder if anyone on frequency knows whether or not a modern-day windshield has a problem with the through-the-glass type of monopole antenna. If so, give us your call letters right now, K2RIW on the TechNet. I was a little bit afraid of that. To actually run the test to find out was not going to be easy. I mean, if you had a test automobile which doesn't have that polka-dotted metal perimeter on the windshield, and you first mount your through-the-glass antenna on that, do a test in a parking lot by measuring signal strength between your car and another car that's at the other end of the parking lot, then with that
N-L-D-Y.
Car...
L-D-Y.
Okay, Don, you can see that I was about to propose that you do a test, but I'll admit it's not easy. Also, by way of standing wave ratio, you may get a hint. If there really is a metallic layer there that is going to strongly disturb the through-the-glass antenna performance, I think there's a 95% chance it'll show up as an extremely high standing wave ratio. So if you've got a way of measuring the standing wave ratio of your through-the-glass antenna when mounted in that area, I think you're going to find out real fast. N2LDY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Don.
Okay, I tried telling you twice that it's the front windshield. It's up way up top on the front windshield, and I'm sure it doesn't have anything to do with the defroster, and the antenna is not in the glass in this car. It's not an antenna that's mounted in the glass.
Okay, I'm a little bit confused now, Don. You said it was a through-the-glass antenna, and I took your word for it. Tell me what kind of an antenna it is we're discussing. Over to you, Don.
No, it's a through-the-glass antenna. All I'm saying is that some cars have their radio reception antenna built into the front windshield glass in some cars, and this doesn't. Defroster couldn't possibly have anything to do with the defroster because it's the front windshield. And no defrost thing up there. It's just like, looks like painted polka dots of black paint to me. You know, that's what the thing I think it is.
Now, what you're saying, Don, is that many of the cars have a bunch of very obvious horizontal stripe metallic strips on the rear window, which does defrosting. That's the way it was done in the old days. There are a few very modern automobiles that have a multi-layer to the windshield on the front windshield of the car, which has a conductive layer built into the windshield, which is a installed defroster function. There are a few cars that have that. Maybe they're only the high-end cars, and maybe yours doesn't have it. But in any case, if that polka-dotted area that you're concerned about really is a metallic thing, or if the automobile antenna is a transparent one that's not obvious to the eye but still is present, if any metallic structure is in your windshield and you're using the through-the-glass antenna, I am almost sure that any disruption of normal 2-meter reception, for instance, would be shown as a change in the standing wave ratio. So if you install your through-the-glass antenna in what you believe is the desirable area, and then you borrow somebody's Berg wattmeter or any other kind of standing wave ratio indicator, if you get a quasi-normal standing wave ratio indication, then most likely the antenna is performing correctly. Let me drop.
Comment, Dick.
I'll pick up with John in a second. See, the external portion of the antenna is a resonant structure. It, with the base of the antenna that's on the inside of the automobile, is a combined capacitive coupling resonator. If the windshield contains metallic objects that are disturbing that flow through of the signal from the internal structure to the external antenna. It'll disturb that resonance, and therefore it'll show up pretty fast as standing wave ratio. That's my belief. Let's see what John's got to say on all this. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the second half.
KC2WGB. Dick, best suggestion, call the auto glass replacement people or the dealer. They'll be able to tell you exactly what that is.
Yeah, there's a slim chance that that polka dotted area is really just a an edge sunshield and decoration and beautification thing. It might not be a portion of the radio of the car. It might not be a portion of a defroster function. But it's something to worry about a little bit. But no matter what it is, if it's going to disturb the performance of your through-the-glass antenna, I think there's almost no way that it could be disturbing the performance without it showing up the standing wave ratio. And if you can get a reasonable standing wave ratio setting, I think you're home free, because that would be a pretty strong confirmation that the signal is getting to the external radiator portion, which has to resonate. And so anything that's in between blocking that signal will stop that resonance. Without that resonance, you're not going to get a proper impedance match on the internal portion, and that's going to show up real fast as standing wave ratio. So I was starting to propose a test in a parking lot between you and a sample car, much too elaborate. The more I think about it, I think your standing wave ratio test is going to tell you 95% of everything you want to know, Don. And by the way, when you do that test, you do install it, and you start talking to repeaters through the glass antenna, through your new windshield, please come back and let us know how it worked, whether it be successful or not successful. You've got our interest. We'd like to know about it, Don. N2LDY, come back in the future. K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it for a final, Don.
Okay. Yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put some double-sided tape on the thing, you know, the external antenna, and on the little matching network box that mounts underneath it. And I'm going to put that just temporarily on a portion of the windshield that has, you know, it's clear glass. And I'll take some good readings there. And then I'll move it up to the area that I really want to mount it, and I'll take some other readings. So I'll let you know what happened.
Yeah, there's one other variable involved here, Don, and that is, it is my belief that the through-the-glass antennas behave well when the internal box is near the perimeter of the glass. In other words, how close that box is to the sheet metal of the car allows it to use the sheet metal of the car as part of the counterpoise, part of the ground plane for the antenna. And if you choose a location on your windshield which is far away from the sheet metal, that in itself will change the standing wave ratio, and it could give you a different reading that could confuse you. So when you read the manual on your through-the-glass antenna, if they have a recommended distance that the internal portion is supposed to be mounted, we're supposed to be mounted some number of inches away from the sheet metal of the car, I do recommend you obey that, because that could make a difference. Once again, when you through all with this reading of the manual and doing this investigation, please come back and let us know what you find out. Bye-bye for now, and good luck with that project, Don. John, how are our questions this week? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead with Mel's corner, or maybe we should start calling it John's corner. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. No, it's Mel's corner, that's for sure. And I have a question. A young ham has a military transmitter. I'm assuming it's 2 meters. Not that it matters. But he cannot take it apart or play with it. He wants to keep it exactly as it is. The problem is, it's a 25-watt transmitter. So he wants to build an attenuator on the antenna output. What he's thinking of doing is using a rotary wafer switch and put 10 resistors on it, approximately 5 ohms each, and have it variably tap each resistor, thinking he's going to get 2.5 watts, whatever. What do you think of that idea? What are the drawbacks? And do you think it'll work? Back to you, Dick.
Before I proceed, John, do you have any idea what frequency range the 25-watt military transmitter is on? Any idea what frequency range? Is it HF versus VHF? Go ahead.
He didn't give me the frequency, but I'm assuming it's 2 meters from his written questions here, the way he's specifying, and the length of the antenna he said he's working with, which is approximately 20 inches, so I'm assuming it's 2 meters.
Yeah, a quarter wave ground plane antenna on 2 meters. The radiator is in the vicinity of 19 inches long, and so it certainly does sound like 2 meters. And I guess he wants to cut down the 25 watts because he's driving maybe a solid state transmitter, which is rated for 10 watts of input. And did he give any hints along those lines? And is he using this transmitter only as a transmitter, or do you think it's a transmitter receiver? Back to you, John.
No, Dick, it's only a transmitter, and he's using a scanner as his receiver. He's using it in a base station, and he wants to be able to lower the power down as much as he can. Maybe he wants to play with QRP, I don't know. But 25 watts is too much power at time for
him. Now, the tapped resistor technique for cutting down the power, and you choose the correct resistors at the correct wattage levels, and it's connected with a rotary switch with short enough leads inside of a well-shielded box, without a doubt that can be made to work. It takes a little bit of mechanical skill and a little bit of RF skill to have good layout of that wiring so you don't pick up extra inductance and give you a little bit of an impedance mismatch. But that can be done. There is another way, and that is on 2 meters, ordinary small diameter coaxial cable is a beautiful linear attenuator. If I used, for instance, coaxial cable that was an eighth of an inch diameter or 3/16 of an inch in diameter, it has quite a number of decibels of loss per 100 feet. And so to knock the power from 25 watts down to, let's say, 10 watts, and that's in the vicinity of 4 dB or so of loss, if I had coaxial cable, very small diameter coaxial cable, that had, for instance, 40 decibels of loss per 100 feet, and I only want 4 dB of loss, one-tenth of that, then a 10-foot length of that cable coiled up, because it's a small diameter cable, it'll fit in the box very nicely. So a length of coaxial cable gives you a rather clearly defined amount of insertion loss. It can tolerate the power. In fact, you could have that rotary switch select different lengths of cable as your different steps to the attenuator, and with careful layout, feeding signals through coaxial cable to various lengths, it's rather easy to get the attenuation you want, the impedance matching you want, and as long as it's only a transmitter, let me drop it. That can work like a charm. The reason I asked the question, is this a transmitter or receiver, is that to add a length of cable as an attenuator, as well as using the resistors as an attenuator in the transmit mode, you might want to be able to wire things in such a way that if it was a transmitter receiver, that in the receiver mode, you're bypassing that attenuator. You'd rather not put an attenuator, most of the time, on a receiver, unless you happen to be located near strong transmitters that are giving you grief, in which case an attenuator on the receiver sometimes is the right approach. But if his is only a transmitter, length of coax cable is another approach that a lot of guys have used very successfully. So properly chosen resistors as a resistor divider network can give you good impedance matching, input and output, and the right amount of attenuation. You got to worry about whether or not these are 25 ohm resistors, 25 watt. When you're dissipating 25 watts down to 10 watts, which means you're really going to be throwing away 15 watts, to find resistors that are good resistors at 15 watts, which means with a safety factor, you're probably choosing a 30 watt resistor, and to choose a 30-watt resistor that really is a resistor at a frequency as high as 144 megacycles, that is difficult. You're going to find out that most of your 30-watt resistors are wire-wound. As such, they really are a great big distributed inductor made out of nichrome wire, and they're going to have more inductance than they do resistance, and life gets a lot more complicated. Using the coaxial cable approach could be quite a bit simpler. I think you see where I'm going on this one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. He'll have to use non-inductive resistors without a doubt. And that, like when you build the antennas, you know, when you...